It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today we're going to be speaking with our guest, Dr. Laura Purdy. She's an MD, MBA, and CEO of Swell Medical Group. Dr. Purdy, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me today. I'm excited to talk to you.
Great, great. I'm looking forward to this interview. And, you know, our audience is regular people dealing with regular issues in life, and sleep being one of those. And I really liked the concept of having you come and talk to us because you are a professional, you're a mom, you're running a business, and I really wanted to learn a little bit from you about how does that all work, how do you keep all the balls in the air, and what does that do, if anything, to your sleep and your abilities for sleeping?
Well, you know what? You could add to the end of that, I'm a mom, I'm a doctor, I'm a business owner, and I'm well-rested. I actually get plenty of sleep. So, but we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Okay. So I'm not even sure how to start here. I do know how to start. Prior to all this, you are a veteran as well, on top of all these things, right?
I am.
So... when did you become a doctor? Kind of give us the timeline and some background on who you are.
At the same time, well, there's a lot of ways to be a doctor in the military in the U.S. And so when it was time for me to go to medical school, which was 2007, the military actually has a medical school. It's in Washington, D.C., technically Bethesda, Maryland. It's called the Uniformed Services University. And I knew at that time, the war was young. America was a very patriotic place. I was in my 20s, and I wanted to serve while going to school. So I joined to go to school, and I became a doctor by the military, in the military. And then my first 7 years in practice, I was working for the Department of Defense, taking care of soldiers, families, and veterans.
Wow. Wow. I did not know that they had a medical school. That's fantastic.
There's only one.
Wow. So you actually spent a lot of years then working with active duty military? Is that true?
Yes, I was. So I was active duty for 14 years, and the majority of the people that you take care of when you are active duty are active duty service members.
Mm-hmm. So in that time, was there sort of certain major issues that you saw more often than others when it came to active duty military?
Ooh, that's a great question. And the answer is absolutely. So over 50, let's talk about my last job. So my last job in the military was something that at the time was called a warrior transition unit surgeon, which I am not a surgeon, but that's what they call the head doctor. And those were for soldiers who have been identified for one reason or another that they were no longer medically going to be able to serve, and they're being transitioned into veteran status. In that population alone, and at any given time, we had about 350 soldiers in our unit that were cycling through, so they wouldn't just stay still. At any given time, over half of our patients had some sort of a mental health condition, which was either the primary reason why they were getting out, or it was just an accessory condition to something else, like a back injury or head injury, or maybe like a cancer even. Over 50% of our patients had some sort of a mental health situation. And a lot of those, you know, we're talking about sleep today. A lot mm-hmm. of those, when you talk about PTSD, depression, anxiety, even the more extreme things like bipolar and schizophrenia, which do happen in the military, there is always a component of sleep disorder and sleep dysfunction. So we had a lot of soldiers that were impacted by that.
Right, right. So that leads me to a question that I'm truly curious about, and that is this. I know that as you and I are talking today, and it's 2024 today, the concept of sleep medicine is really starting to be recognized by the medical community and by the mental health community. And we're recognizing the tie-in to all these different disorders, mental and physical health related to sleep. And my question to you is, when you were in the training to become a doctor and deal with the different types of issues, did you get any training about sleep, or when did you first start to make the connection between sleep and some of these other issues?
I actually really did. I feel very fortunate for the education that I underwent, because the hospital that I trained at, we were what you call an unopposed residency. So we actually had one or two sleep medicine specialists that were faculty. Our hospital had a sleep lab that we rotated in. Yeah. Myself did not do a fellowship, but it is. Sleep medicine is a fellowship you can have from family medicine. So it's a part of our education. It's a part of our training. We got a couple weeks of experience up there, and we had a lot of education specifically on sleep. So I don't think that that is a typical experience of all family medicine doctors, but I did have an excellent education from the beginning and have always had that, we could say, context in my practice and even in my personal life, understanding how valuable high quality good sleep is, impacting the health and wellness of the rest of a person's life.
Right. Well, you know, that's one of the interesting things about when I speak to different guests on this show, when I speak to people who work in the European Union area, in the UK, in that part of the world, I always get told that, oh yeah, sleep is absolutely something that is just standard question for any sort of primary care physician. It's part of what we do. But when I speak to people from the US, it tends to be, it's catching on, but it's certainly not on average something that would definitely be part of an exam. So it's interesting to see how it sort of is taking hold in different parts of the world. So when you were actually working with the patients as you were in the military there, can you tell us what type of sleep issues you might have seen co-occurring with other things, or as primary issues or secondary issues? What things would come up?
Well, I would say a couple different buckets, right? So the military is a very atypical work environment with the time of day. They have you report for formation or for your analysis. I can actually remember, this is a true story, showing up to work at 5 a.m. with my less than 2-year-old toddler because I could not get a nanny. It's a true story. Could not get a nanny to come to my house that early. And the daycares on post weren't even open that early. So you would think, why are you having people come to work that early? It was punitive. Somebody did something wrong, and everybody, including myself, got punished for it. So here I come with my 18-month-old, now she's 11, 18-month-old toddler to formation. And you think about, what does that do to your sleep schedule? So you have circadian rhythm problems. You have shift work disorders because you are pulling 24-hour duty, or you're up all night training in the field. And if you put on top of that what it's like to be a healthcare worker, 24-hour shifts, getting called to come in at all time of the day or night, getting called when you're on, you know, every 20, 30 minutes, an hour, being up for blocks of time and trying to squeeze in your sleep in between, and then stack being a parent on top of that, you see a lot of things. Circadian rhythm disorders, shift work disorder, patients who have PTSD, or soldiers or veterans who have PTSD, they have trouble falling asleep, they have frequent nightmares, they have trouble staying asleep, they wake up in a panic and then take a long time to get back. There is a lot of sleep disturbance. And then if you think about things like taking antidepressants or taking pain medication, there are lots of different medications that can cause sleep problems, even though they help with other conditions.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, you know, there's a lot there. And I guess my curiosity has taken me to this question, which is, so while you are now seeing patients that have all of these different types of sleep disorders as part of what you're dealing with, how much attention does the military give to the sleep disorder? Is it, well, we recognize you have it, but, you know, it's not a big deal? Or do they actually pay attention to treating it properly?
Well, here's the problem, right? In the military, there's a big stack of books there's like a big book with a stack of conditions that you can or can't have in order to be serving, and you have to be able to deploy. So does the Army care? Of course they do. They will care on paper. Yes, of course, we want everyone to sleep. But the military has to be able to execute its missions. They have to be able to move forward. And you have to be able to learn how to function. You know, I'll put my soldier hat back on. You have to be able to function at little to no sleep and still have a high level of performance and acuity, or you're not fit to be a warfighter. You're just not, right? So
right.
I think while the Army cares, and while as military professionals we are obligated, military healthcare professionals, we're obligated to care, eventually there will come a point in time where if your sleep dysfunction or your sleep disorder is so severe, you will be discharged from service, because falling asleep on post, falling asleep on duty, having to take things like Ambien or sedating or tranquilizing medications to sleep, this is not compatible with service. So while we do care, we will not ever care. I say we like I'm still there. But they will not care enough to allow you to continue serving if you have a condition that disqualifies you. And that may be the way that they care, by stewarding you out and allowing the VA to take it from there.
Right, right. I would just have to assume that if that's the case, and I'm someone who is an active duty, you know, military, in active duty military service, and I know that, then I may be, you know, tempted to hide my sleep disorder because I don't want to run into those types of problems.
That depends. There's multiple types of soldiers, okay? There are soldiers who want to stay forever and not ever report any of their issues. There are soldiers who want to report them right away so they can get discharged and get a big VA benefit. And I think there's a spectrum on both sides, but that's what the systems are for, right? What those systems are for. If you truly have a debilitating sleep disorder that prevents you from being able to do your job, then you are entitled to be medically retired, to get compensation for the rest of your life, and to get free health care at the VA. That is what those systems are there for. And there are both types of soldiers out there.
Right, right. But ultimately, I guess if somebody comes in for healthcare treatment and it is found that they have a sleep disorder as one of the things that needs to be addressed, in the military, through your experience, they are going to get the help that they need.
Absolutely, yes. The resources are there. The specialists are there. Everything is there to give them exactly what they need.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then in terms of, you know, one of the other things I think a lot of people think about when they hear the term military is PTSD, because PTSD is obviously heavily related to the types of service and situations that many military people may find themselves in. And did you see, in terms of active duty, did you see a lot of people with PTSD issues, and was that impacting their sleep?
A lot. Because you have to think about when I served, right? The war was at its peak when I entered. 2007, the surge was in 2008, and you had the soldiers who had done Fallujah and the initial offensives in Iraq and Afghanistan from 2001 to 2007, and then I was in for the following decade. So I saw a ton of PTSD, and there are lots and lots. But even if you don't go to a combat zone, being taken away from your family for a year, being in training accidents, being in harsh environments, being around war victims, you know, being around families who've had loss, it's a traumatic experience. And so I think a lot of people who have served or are serving have PTSD, and sleep disturbances are one of the primary symptom categories, because you have a heightened level of arousal and a heightened level of vigilance, which is that feeling like you have to always be looking to see what's happening around you. So yeah, difficulty falling asleep, nightmares, difficulty staying asleep. There's a lot to that, but yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, let me do this. Let's take a break for a commercial. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about what we do for those people with PTSD. And then we got a lot of other things I want to cover. So hang on. Great. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. the station that makes you feel good.
All right, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're speaking with Dr. Laura Purdy. And just before the break, we were talking about PTSD in the military. So if you have someone who has PTSD and it is impacting their sleep, maybe they're even having nightmares or things, are there treatments available to them that are effective in your experience?
There really are. Honestly, there very much is. And I think we, as a, we'll say, medical community, have learned enough about this illness and this population that the care is so much better now than it used to be. It's not the type of thing that just a medication is going to fix. This requires therapy, whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy or DBT. There's lots of different types of therapy. You actually probably know more about the types of therapy than I do, because I don't do therapy. But therapy works. And in conjunction with medication, these people can really be, if you could say, rehabilitated, or they can be put into remission, where they can reengage with their lives and participate more than they would have been if they were still having a lot of active symptoms.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's, you know, that's sort of, I guess, something I alluded to earlier, is that now that the medical community and just the community in general is becoming more aware of sleep issues and the fact that there are opportunities and treatments available to help people with various different sleep disorders, more people are becoming aware of it, i.e. more diagnosis. More diagnosis means more ability to treat and then more people getting better. So that's the good news story that we're in right now in that part of the community. So we talked a lot about the military, but now I'm curious, we move forward, eventually you leave the military and you open up your own practice, correct?
I did.
Okay. And so in the types of patients that you saw after you came out of the military, did you find that there was also a sleep connection to any of the types of mental/physical health issues that people might approach you with?
Yes. So as we were talking, I was remembering back to a company that I worked at from about 2018 to 2021 or so, 2020, right before and then kind of during the pandemic. And this was a behavioral health company. That's all it was we did depression and anxiety. And I had a panel of patients that were just mine. I would meet with over video and talk with them about what was going on. And all of those patients, or I'll say almost all of those patients, sleep was a problem. Whether it's because they were, you know, so depressed and they were sleeping too much, or they had a lot of anxiety and they weren't sleeping enough, or panic disorder. I mean, sleep really goes hand in hand. And I think also there is a chicken and egg component. It can be the mental health that causes the sleep problems, or the sleep problems can cause the mental health, and they get so intertwined, right? That I'm sure you see this as a mental health professional. They're so intertwined that you really do have to look at and address each one of them independently and also together to give your patient the best result.
Yeah. No, that's so true. And it's, you know, work. I'm just thinking back to my own client load and thinking of different patients. And when they come in, you know, they can come in with the same type of thing that's bothering them, meaning I'm having trouble falling asleep or I'm having trouble staying asleep. But then when you start to get into it and learn more about what's really going on for them, there can be multiple different reasons why that's the case. And if you're going to provide treatment, you have to treat what's going on for them. You can't just say, oh, well, in general, here's a treatment and everyone's fine. That's just not the way it works. And then, you know, this is why today it's so important that mental health professionals and physical health professionals work so closely, because, like you said, there's so many things that I'm sure you work with patients on from a physical health perspective that then impacts their sleep that they would benefit from mental health. So my question was, we have patients who go to their primary care physician for a variety of things. And we have primary care physicians who are working, obviously, with a very broad type of issue. My question was, what types of things should a patient think about bringing forth to their doctor as relates to sleep and the other things they're talking about? And what type of things should a primary care physician be thinking about, at least looking into, in order to make a diagnosis for whatever the issue may be for that patient?
Gosh, you know, that's a good question, and it's really challenging. It's challenging to be a patient living your life and experiencing whatever it is you experience. And you might think that it's normal. You might not know that something needs to be brought up to your doctor. I'll tell you a really good example is exhaustion. Feeling tired all day, every day, and you should never be falling asleep during the day, ever, ever. There's no reason why a person should be falling asleep during the day, especially not falling asleep at the wheel or feeling sluggish, feeling exhausted, yawning all the time. Those are the types of symptoms that really could signify that you've got something going on with your sleep. And then conversely, I think it's the doctor's job, knowing that your patient might not realize that they need to bring something up to you. It's so common. They'll say, oh, I just thought that was normal, or I thought everybody experienced that, and it might not be the case. So I think it should be a good part of a routine, we'll say annual screening, for the doctor to be asking questions. I mean, we have no problem asking about things like alcohol and drugs and eating and exercise and tobacco. So why not be asking about sleep as well? It doesn't take a long time to say, how many hours of sleep do you get at night? Do you have any problem falling asleep? Do you have any problem staying asleep? Are you sleepy and exhausted during the day? It took no time to ask those questions. So why not add them in? I mean, you know, I would give you a break to answer in the office, but it doesn't take any time to add on those handful of questions, and that can be very impactful to your patient's well-being.
Right, right. And you know what? Just as we're talking about that related to an MD, the same questions are relevant when you're talking about a mental health care practitioner. You know, when I went to school for mental health, we never talked about sleep. We never talked about how it may impact or work in conjunction with other issues. But, you know, the more that I learn about it, the more that I realize that those same questions are important for me to ask my patients, because it oftentimes is an issue, but the patient never thought to raise it because they just figured, well, I'm just a bad sleeper, you know? So
it might be.
Really, when you start to ask about it and learn about it, you find things that they can get help with that they didn't even realize, or that impacts the other help that you were going to be providing, that now you have a bigger picture and a better way to do it. One of the sort of back and forth challenges between the medical physical health providers and the mental health providers when it comes to sleep is, you know, mental health training is more about your CBTI and other types of things to help you with insomnia, nightmares, etc. The medical doctors, especially primary care, if they don't specialize in sleep, what they're trained and what they know to do is to provide certain types of pills, you know, Ambien, Trazodone, different types of pills. And, yep. You know, the pills do what the pills do, but they don't really give restful sleep, and they don't really address the core problem, but the patient doesn't know there's anything else to do. So eventually a patient comes in for mental health care for CBTI or something, and they never heard of it. And their doctor, in many cases, had never heard of it. And they find out, wow, you mean I can actually get restful sleep and get off of medication? Well, in many cases, yes, you can. But so, you know, it's hard when a doctor finally sends someone, but they put them on all these pills, and then it's like, well, you know, okay, we kind of got to work in conjunction to decide whether you really need these pills and how to weigh it all out.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not the doctor's fault, right? Like, it's not the patient's fault. It's not the doctor's fault. But I think that's why it's important that there is more awareness, more knowledge coming from the people and from the doctors, so that maybe moving forward we can be more collaborative, more educated, more understanding, and not just be throwing out Ambien like candy at a parade to everybody.
Right, right. No, I'm 100% agreeing with you. It is not their fault. It is their training, and they are doing their best with what they know and what they're trained. And that's why I say that learning as a patient, learning as a doctor, learning as a mental health practitioner, what questions to ask, what things to think about, so that you can coordinate care together. Because ultimately, everybody's goal is to give the best care to the patient and for the patient to not have any issues that they're concerned about. So, but that's the beauty of even like a radio show like this, putting out information to people so that they know. Ask these questions. There are good things out there. There are good doctors out there. They want to work with you, but they got to have the info, you know, so you got to share with them what's going on.
Got to have the info.
yeah. So, all right. So there's one other area that I want to talk about here related to the sleep. And then I want to talk a little bit more about you and the realities of what you're working with. But my question here is, so we're talking about doctors and health and sleep and all that, and we know that there are prescription sleep meds that are available that people use. We also know that there's a lot of over-the-counter supplements out there that say that they're good for sleep, and you can find articles, you know, about all sorts of things. And melatonin is one big one that I think people just automatically think about when they think about sleep, and that's out there. So we talk about that sometimes, but then there's another one. Excuse me, magnesium, which a lot of people will look to for sleep issues, but I think it's not as people don't know as much about it as they do maybe about melatonin or something. And originally, you know, I found you because of some work you had done, an article about melatonin. And so I wanted to take the opportunity to pick your brain to share this information with the audience about I don't know what I said. Magnesium is what I meant to say. I'm not sure what I said.
Melatonin. They both start with an M.
Okay. Magnesium is what I'm trying to talk about here, as opposed to melatonin. So so in terms of magnesium, can you tell us what is it and why do people equate it with sleep?
So I think it's important to give a good disclaimer here, right? Because this is not meant to be a substitute for medical advice. So I would not advise anybody who is listening to this podcast to run out and go to the store and buy magnesium and start taking it right now. There is no blanket recommendation. There is no medical recommendation or guideline that says you guys should really be taking magnesium because it's going to help with your sleep, okay? So we're talking more like hypothetical, theoretical potentials, all right? So correct. Magnesium is an element. It's a mineral. It's on the periodic table. And it serves a lot of functions in your body. It does a lot with the heart. It does a lot with the muscles. It does do a lot with the brain. And it is a substance that has a very narrow window of, you could say, like high and low, where it's supposed to live. And it's regulated by organs in your body, like the kidneys, whose responsibility is to make sure you have enough, but not too much, not too little, right? So some people can find, if they have a deficiency of magnesium, you can have things like feeling sluggish or heart palpitations or cramps in your muscles. We see that a lot in people who take certain medications or maybe get a lot of exercise. So there are certain subsets of people who can benefit from taking magnesium, who might have more regular bowel movements. That's another one. We see a lot of magnesium activity in the gut. But sleep can be one. There are some sleep supplements out there that contain a little bit of magnesium. There are people who swear by magnesium to help them relax and fall to sleep in the evening. But again, there's no blanket recommendation that says everyone should do this if they want to sleep better.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. And yes, 100%, this is not a show about recommending medications or supplements to people. We're just sharing information, but it's important that you check with your doctor for appropriate, you know, advice. So let me break for another commercial break here real quick, and we'll come back. And I got a couple more questions about magnesium, and then we're going to move forward. So we'll be right back.
UK Health Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All right, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Dr. Laura Purdy, and we were just talking about magnesium when we were talking about different types of sleep medications and supplements. And one of the things that I had read in the article, actually, where I initially found you, was the concept of a magnesium overdose. And I wonder if you can share with us what is a magnesium overdose, how would I know if I had it, and what would it do to me?
Well, so it's actually kind of simple to think about. When we last spoke, we talked about some of the organs in the body that can be impacted by low magnesium, okay? So same organs, brain, heart, muscles, gut, intestines, same organs that are affected by a deficiency are also affected by toxicity, which is kind of the opposite. The medical would say toxicity or overdose. But magnesium, because it has such a profound impact at the cellular level, each individual little cell, you can definitely have too much of a good thing. So overdosing on magnesium, you can have seizures. I mean, you can die. You can absolutely die from magnesium toxicity. Actually, I do have a story I could share with you. Sure. When I was pregnant with my first child, I had preeclampsia. And the treatment for preeclampsia is IV magnesium. And the thought is you're stabilizing the brain, because people who have preeclampsia can progress to eclampsia and you can get seizures. So magnesium stabilizes those connections in the brain and keeps you from having a seizure. So I was getting IV magnesium, and you have to check your blood levels because you can overdose. And sure enough, I had magnesium toxicity. I got overdosed on magnesium. It's nobody's fault. The healthcare team did exactly what they were supposed to do. They were monitoring it appropriately, but I was hallucinating. I literally, the whole shape of the room changed. The people looked different. I didn't know where I was. We talked about muscles. I had profound muscle weakness to the point where I could not pick my arms up off the bed to hold the baby. You want to talk about exhaustion, sleep? I could not stay awake. I was so drowsy, I was falling asleep. I did have it's kind of gross, but I had incontinence everywhere. And it was a magnesium overdose. And thankfully, we were monitoring it, and the treatment was just to stop the magnesium for a little while and get it going again when it reached a normal range. But this is why I say to people, you really have to be careful if you're choosing to use a supplement, because an overdose of magnesium can be a very serious and life-threatening thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. No, I appreciate you sharing that story, because, you know, another thing that we commonly read in articles and journals when they look at these different supplements is, because there's no real regulation over supplements, the bottle may say it's strength X, but when they test it, it's strength Y. And so True. You really don't know for sure what you're getting. And that can be dangerous if you're taking, you know, too much and you don't even realize it, because you think you're taking a certain amount based on what the label says, but you may not be getting that. You may be getting more.
True.
So, okay, well, I appreciate that. I wanted to make sure that I covered that, because it's a question that people have. So, all right. So now let's move to sort of your life today. So you've done your medical school, you've done all this training, you've worked with patients, you've seen the issues, and now you're a mom. You told us about your 11-year-old. I don't know if you have any more kids or not, but you're a mom, you're a doctor, you're a business person. What does that do to someone like you for your sleep? What should people be thinking about when they are trying to manage work and kids and school and all these things?
I have 4 children. They're all about to have birthdays. So we'll say 11, 9, 7, and 4. Those are my four kids. And I spent a lot of years getting absolutely no sleep. I got no sleep for many, many, many years because none of my children were sleepers. And, you know, I didn't really ascribe to the cry it out method of sleep training. I assisted them with their falling asleep. I still do. My four-year-old got out of bed 3 times last night. But for me, sleep, and I've actually gone on record saying this for years. One of the first press articles I was ever in was a Medium article, I think in like 2020 maybe, or 2021, where I said sleep is the most important thing for me when it comes to wellness. I get 7 to 8 hours of sleep every night. Even if that means I go to bed at 9:30, I will go to bed at 9:30. And I work from home. My children go to a school that starts at 9 o'clock, and I live 5 minutes away. So I don't have to get up at 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning. I make sure that I have one cup of coffee in the morning. I don't have caffeine after 12. I don't have a television in my bedroom. Neither do the children, by the way. I really don't drink caffeine before bed. I'm actually very, very aware. I don't have an alarm clock in my room. I don't have any big digital red lights that I can look at. If I do get up in the middle of the night, I don't look at my phone. I don't want to know what time it is. That's like, I think, leftover from just parenting of small children trauma. But these days I don't take red eye flights anymore. In 2022 and 2023, I traveled over 50% of the time, and I took a lot of red eye flights so that I could maximize my time with the children. I don't do that anymore. Right. I don't do red eye flights because that's just not good for me physically or emotionally. It's not good. So I really do prioritize sleep. If I go out for a work event, because now we do a lot of work with festival and event healthcare brands, I will make sure there's an overnight babysitter so that I can sleep in the morning if I need to. And I don't drink alcohol before bed. I mean, there's a lot that I do to give myself the best chance possible at being able to get as much sleep as possible. And it pays off tremendously in my daily life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's great. You really got sort of your sleep hygiene mastered with all of those things that you're doing the right way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, too big of a list for me to go through right now, but everything that you just said, yes, I agree with. Excuse me. So with that, you now are, as we introduced you in the beginning, you're CEO of Swell Medical Group. So what is Swell Medical Group? What do you all do on a regular basis?
Well, Swell Medical Group is what it sounds like. It's a medical group. It's a nationwide medical group of doctors, nurse practitioners, and PAs, and nurses. We have nurses, too, that assist companies with telemedicine offerings in all 50 states. We do services for in-person clinics and facilities as well, who can do some treatments in person, but they want virtual assessments of their patients. So we have patients from all across the country with many different kinds of backgrounds, many different type of health, we'll say ailments that they're experiencing. And we do the best that we can to meet them where they are and treat them as best as we can within the limits of virtual care.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. And is that something that you started on your own?
On accident, yeah. I mean, I come from the telemedicine industry. So my first job was at MD Live. I was a full-time physician there, and then I became one of the practice medical directors. Then I was one of the national medical directors. I think they called it regional, for Hims and Hers, which is huge. Worked as a consultant or a freelancer for probably hundreds of telemedicine companies across the country. Then I was the chief medical officer at Open Loop Health for a while. And now I work for myself. So.
Fantastic. Wow.
Well, it's exciting.
I know there's a lot of different opinions out there about telehealth and all, but personally, I fall in the bucket of I think it's a really beneficial thing because it offers access to so many people that wouldn't otherwise have easy access to, especially specialists. You know, if you're living in a more rural area, you're not going to have specialists that treat things that only a small number of people treat, for example. And through telehealth, you now have direct access, and you don't even have to go drive anywhere. You can just open up your computer and talk to a doctor. So my practice itself is solely telehealth for those reasons, because I'm able to see people that are hundreds of miles away or in other states where I'm licensed, and they get the same care, and, you know, it's just so much easier. So, okay, well, we have had an opportunity to talk about a lot of things, and I really appreciate you taking time to share your experience and your stories with us about things you've dealt with. And, you know, it's such an important area, as we can see from what you've shared with us, of how sleep ties into everything. And, you know, good news being that there are different types of treatments available that are not just medicine-based treatments, but actually mental health-based treatments, behavioral treatments. So there's a whole panoply of things that are available to people. And it's a matter of finding the right one that's right for you. So making sure to speak with your doctor and share the information about what's going on with you so that they have the benefit of knowing. So any last words, Dr. Purdy?
Well, first of all, I couldn't have said it better myself, Andrew. I think you summarized the issue beautifully. Thank you for having me. And if you're listening to this and you're thinking, gosh, I'm a horrible sleeper, or man, I'm tired all day, I would encourage you to talk to somebody. Give Andrew a call. Maybe he's licensed in your state. But I think if you're dealing with sleep issues, I want you to understand that you are not alone and there is help out there. And if you're miserable and you're suffering from a sleep condition, which is a lot of people across the world, just know that you can reach out and get some help.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And to all of you that are listening, a reminder to take some time, go to sleepsciencetoday.com, sign up to be in our mailing list, because you will be notified of important things, and you'll find that you'll be able to watch this show. If you want to see the actual show on YouTube, that comes up after it launches on the radio. So you'll be able to find us, and you can actually see Dr. Purdy and watch the conversation. So thank you, everybody, and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Sleep Science Today.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.